This is Pirate Nick, and I'm here with John Shook, who is a wildlife biologist up in Alaska, down here in Southern California for a getaway from the cold. Hi, John.
Hey there, Nick.
All right, so John, wildlife biologist, what do you study? What's your field?
Well, I'm an ornithologist, studying different bird populations within the state of Alaska. My specialty is on raptors and birds of prey. There, and a lot of my work's been on peregrine falcons that were endangered. I worked on them before they got off the endangered species list, and now it's a successful species that has left the list of endangered species. It's a success story, and it's good, and we'd like to see more of that, happen in the future.
Are there any other birds of prey or raptors that are endangered that you study up in Alaska?
No, right now up in Alaska we don't have any other endangered species that I work on. There's the Queen Charlotte goshawk down in southeast Alaska that there's been petitioned to be put on the endangered species list, but it's not likely to happen anytime soon.
So tell us a little bit about your field work, because that is really the interesting part of your job, isn't it? It's not sitting in the lab combing through data, or are you one of those strange people that actually enjoys
this? Oh, no. No, I enjoy the field work for sure, and Alaska's a great place to do that. The summers are short and brilliant, and so the field work comes in a flurry often, and you work long and hard, and you can work all through the night sometimes when it's light enough in June and July and August. So we work hard in the summers, and then the winters you comb through the data, like you say, and write up reports and put that all together and to a big picture. And a lot of stuff I enjoy doing is long-term research, population monitoring. So
for example, what's something that you've been studying long-term?
Well, for example, I've been studying a peregrine falcon population on the Tanana River since 1997.
And where's the Tanana River in relation to, you know, the big cities that everybody knows in Alaska, Fairbanks, Anchorage?
Good question. Well, Anchorage is our only big city, really, and then Fairbanks has got 60 or 80,000 people spread out in the interior of the state. And that interior of the state is characterized by the Tanana River Valley. It's a glacial river that has meandered across the valley and made it very broad and pretty flat there in the interior. There's also the Yukon River Valley, which is a much bigger river further north near the Arctic Circle. So this Tanana River cuts cliffs out of the topography as it winds across the valley, and on those cliffs peregrine falcons have been nesting for as long as man has been around. And peregrine falcons have been around, and this population has gone up and down. And during the DDT crisis for raptors, the peregrine falcon population on the Tanana River was down to about 2 pairs.
Real briefly, explain the DDT crisis. What that was a chemical, right?
Yep, a chemical pesticide that persists a long time in the environment. It doesn't break down. And that pesticide is eaten by insects, and those insects might be eaten by small birds, and then raptors may eat those small birds. The DDT also washes into waterways, creeks, and can be consumed by fish or invertebrates that are consumed by fish, and then bald eagles would be eating those fish. So bald eagles were also impacted by the DDT, and it causes this thinning of eggshells in these species, and that is what caused the population declines in them, because they would lay the eggs and they would basically immediately crack, or any time they turned the eggs they would crack because they were so weak. So on the Tanana, as far as the years that were surveyed in the 70s, they were quite low numbers, down to just a 2 or 3 pairs on the river. And then as soon as they were they banished the use of DDT in North America, the numbers slowly but steadily began increasing. And now we can find about 50 pairs of falcons. So it's a really, it's a happy story of recovery of a population due to people changing their behaviors. And it was a nationwide or a continent-wide success story with a lot of people getting together to come together for conservation of species. And they were charismatic species, peregrines and bald eagles, and so that's why people could really get behind this. You know, it's really a success story for conservation and not specifically just for this species. It's a good example of how to come together, you know, across international borders even, and do some real conservation. And it takes many parts. You know, what most people are familiar with is what is in the media, and there's several other stories that the media never even picks up because the media isn't even familiar with some of the more in-depth research and scientific research that's going on out there. And they're usually more in tune with environmentalists, which tend to be more interesting for the general public. I mean, it's, you know, on one hand you have environmentalists, which are usually kind of on the far extreme, and on the other side you have people that are not at all interested in the environment. They're just interested in, say, profit, that don't care about the environment. And the media really tends to pit those two against each other. And like in politics, the middle isn't all that interesting to the media, and they're often trying to feed off of fear and money mongering. And so it's kind of difficult or disappointing sometimes as a scientist to see what's out there in the media, because, you know, they're not telling the whole story. They're telling the sensational stories. And really, for good conservation to work, there's several different levels of people that need to get together, and for the people to get together, they need to really identify the common threads that everybody's interested in.
So what are some examples then of ways that you are treading that middle ground, where you're doing some biology studies, some wildlife studies for maybe companies that need to operate in the Alaskan area? What are some examples of you guys working together to find a common ground that's going to allow maybe them to go forward with some kind of business venture that's not going to affect the environment in a bad way?
Mm-hmm.
Have there been any examples of that?
Yeah, there's some decent people out there and some decent companies that do try and work with science and work with some ideas of conservation in order to meet the needs of both their shareholders or their company and the needs to protect the environment. There's lots of research going on in the oil fields that most people are familiar with in Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk on the North Slope of Alaska, where early on in the life of the oil fields, people and the companies were fairly resistant to spending money on research of animals. But as the public's view has kind of softened and been more sympathetic to wildlife and to the people, the native people that live up there and rely on the wildlife for their food and clothing, it's called subsistence living, They the companies have come around recently and been, they go a little bit beyond the minimum requirements that the state and the federal government imposes. And, you know, maybe that's to really improve the their public opinion of these oil companies. And maybe it's because they really do care.
Well, I guess the bottom line there, though, is if, have there been any studies that they've commissioned that has told them you can't do this and stop them from doing a venture that they wanted to do?
That normally doesn't happen. Usually what happens is a study might identify a critical area for wildlife or, say, wetlands habitat that that conservationists would say, you know, you shouldn't put a road through here or drill here or have increased levels of activity because it's going to have a bad effect, potentially long term. So what they'll do is they call, you know, mitigation procedures, and they may make a compromise. And there are examples of power lines or roadways that have avoided and gone around, say, peregrine falcon nests, bald eagle nests, timber harvests that weren't allowed to cut down trees, you know, within a mile of a bald eagle nest. Or
so then have some of your studies of the peregrine falcons yielded data that
oh, yes,
makes these companies have to stay away from particular areas of the Tanana River?
The Tanana, not in the Tanana specifically, that's not much of an issue because there's no development going on really
out there.
So then
you've been studying peregrine falcons elsewhere as well?
Yeah, I've studied them elsewhere, and on another river, the 40-mile river, there's small dredges that recreational gold miners use, and they set up a long-term camp over the summertime, and we identify cliffs that are occupied that they cannot camp right directly across from or run their small dredge during these breeding months.
And how do you know that activity is going to disturb the peregrines?
Well, there's been years and years of behavioral observations of different species, and several of these studies have shown that during critical periods of the breeding season, during incubation and territory setup, pair bonding during their courtship, that increased human activity can decrease the success of these nesting birds. Some birds are more resilient than others, and some are more sensitive. Some might be young. It might be the first time that they've tried breeding, so a smaller scale disturbance might, you know, put them off, and they might decide to not breed that year because they were questionable about it anyways. They're adolescents, basically, and they don't know what they're doing. Some birds in Alaska, almost all of our birds migrate. So some of these peregrine falcons spend their winter in Chicago, in the city, or in San Diego. You see them in these totally remote situations with no signs of humans around, but they could well spend their winters surrounded by...
In a city.
A concrete jungle, yeah. Yeah, so they may be desensitized to more of this, you know, human disturbance and sounds of motors and people and stuff like that. And some may be more sensitive because they spend their winter in Argentina in a rainforest or without many people around.
Yeah. Since we're talking about Alaska and the natural environment there, let's just touch on a really big issue that's been a part of the media in the recent past, which is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the protection of that against oil interests. Recently, that's been preserved. How do you feel that's helped helped the environment in Alaska?
Well, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is an example of a pristine environment, an untouched open space of unprecedented size. So there are many untouched pristine places in North America, but it's hard to find one that is millions of acres big. And so this is a fight both for the immediate practicality of saving this space, but also it's kind of a fight for conservation and the idea of America being a place that has large, open, pristine places. I mean, our country used to be very rich in wildlife and open, pristine places. And over the very short course of a few hundred years, we have marched across the continent and exterminated buffalo and, you know, wild prairie and habitats and countless wildlife species. And so it's harder and harder to find these large spaces that haven't been disturbed by humans, and especially industrialized humans that have consumed chunks of land. And so if you start developing in a small space, even if there's millions of acres, what happens is some kind of a fragmentation of habitats. And that's a big problem in the lower 48, especially, where fragmented habitats, even though there might be hundreds and hundreds of acres if you put them together, but if there's roads and industrialized areas or track houses that break up that landscape, it's no longer a whole anymore. It's smaller parts, and the smaller parts are never as good as the whole. And
do you see that affecting generally the larger species on the food chain first, or does it not distinguish between sizes of animals? I mean, are you getting small animals affected when you get that fragmentation as well?
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking in terms of bears and mountain lions that need big roaming ranges. I would think that they would be the ones that are impacted first. Do you find that's true or not?
Well, in general, yes, the larger animals, especially predators, need larger territories. And predators are often wary of humans because of their persecution over the years as well. And so they need larger spaces to feel comfortable and in order to just get enough food. They need to cover many, many miles every day. Up on the North Slope, the proponents of drilling in Anwar would argue that it would be a very small footprint, less than, 1,000 acres or 2,000 acres, which seems insignificant given the scale of Anwar. But from what I've seen, that would get the oil company's foot in the door, and likely they will sprawl from there, just like you see urban sprawl out from a city, spiraling out from a city and gobbling up open space and turning it into fragmented habitat. That's what I would predict would happen in Anwar. The companies would get their foot in the door and then say, well, we just want to go 10 miles over here, and we're just going to put this small little road and pipeline, and you won't even notice.
And at that point, the environmentalists have lost the argument that it is a pristine area, because it no longer is.
Yeah.
And they can't say that anymore. That's
true.
Sort of their golden ticket right now, isn't it?
That's true.
So then Anwar is, right now, Anwar's a success story. The peregrine falcons are a success story. I can't let you go without talking about some of the, you know, getting it a little darker and talking about some problems, letting people know what is going on up there that does need to be made aware to everybody.
Importantly, you said right now Anwar is a success story. Of course, it'll be voted on again and again, but certainly with our current change of Senate and House, it's gonna be a while before they could vote to drill in Anwar, but that's not gonna go away. It'll still be there, mm-hmm. voted on over and over again.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, but I think that has been a bit of a smokescreen for drilling further to the west of Anwar in the NPRA. It's the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. And there's a critical habitat area near the Teshikpuk Lake, the largest lake in Alaska. It's 10 miles wide and
wow.
10 miles across. It's more like an ocean in some respects. And it's a critical area for geese molting. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of geese stage there and molt in safety from predators, so they lose all their feathers and they are flightless for a few weeks. And caribou calving. Caribou calve there and raise their young when they're very young and vulnerable to predators. And this is kind of like a safe zone for them that they've been using, you know, for thousands and thousands of years. And recently the BLM has opened Bureau of Land Management has opened this critical habitat area for leases for the oil companies to lease the land to exploratory drilling. And this area seems to be teeming with wildlife even compared to Anwar, where Anwar's in the news and very flashy and headline news. Hardly anything has been said about this Teshikpuk Lake area. And then when Anwar got canned in the Senate, from what I understand, the Bush administration told the BLM they weren't happy with their critical designation of this habitat, and they told them to rewrite the report and tell us that it's less critical and so that we can approve drilling there. And so that was pretty disappointing that this wasn't really covered very much in the media, because in my opinion it's a much more pristine area worth protection. But it's been called the NPRA, the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. So,
and it makes it sound like there's already drilling there.
So yeah, it sounds like it's, you know, we're supposed to drill there. But, you know, we can change these designations through voting and redistricting of these areas. And and so we'll see what happens with the NPRA. That has been stalled. I believe the Wildlife Society and others have petitioned to stall the leasing of these areas. Mm-hmm. So it's in the courts again. And they're not allowed to lease currently, and they must revisit the report to see, you know, where they may have gone wrong. But it was an example of I thought was a bit of an example of, you know, look over here at Anwar, meanwhile they knew that in the back door they could go over here to the NPRA and drill if they want to.
Well, and there's pressures everywhere for the drilling. I mean, I know the Wilderness Society is trying to make people aware of over 100,000 drilling sites in the Rockies that they're trying to get approval for. Mm-hmm. So it seems like just a constant battle to keep a lot of these wild areas wild.
Yeah, it's a and it's an uphill battle with an administration that's very pro-development and using, maybe even using fear tactics to justify, you know, trampling these pristine areas because of terrorism. You know, we don't want to be dependent on foreign oil. Well, if you don't want to be dependent on foreign oil, you need to be working on alternative energy sources, and that's where you should be pouring your money and your resources into developing the dependence from oil, not the dependence on foreign oil. Mm-hmm. And
because realistically, we don't have enough oil in North American territories to replace that foreign oil source anyway, do we?
No, absolutely not.
I mean, not an oil petroleum institute specialist,
right?
But we're kind of getting away from what you study, but it is such a, the oil companies do have such a large impact on wildlife up there in Alaska that you are dealing with it quite frequently, aren't you?
Yeah, we're certainly dealing with it. And
what are some other pressures besides the oil company up there on the environment?
Up in the northern Alaska on the North Slope, there is no other pressure.
That's because is there no timber up there?
There's no timber at all. It's open, unforested tundra, and there's scattered villages of a few hundred to a few thousand people up there that depend on the wildlife for some of their food. They depend on geese and ducks and caribou to some extent. Caribou mostly. They're a big food source. And also fish. They do a lot of fishing in the summertime. And so there's this balance between the oil companies basically leasing the land from the North Slope borough. So a lot of money comes into these villages from the oil companies, but at a cost of some subsistence harvest. Yeah. Perhaps the caribou, they appear to change some of their migratory movements. So now the caribou aren't coming as close to villages as they used to, and it's harder to get out and hunt them, or perhaps they're avoiding crossing roads, you know, that oil companies have put in, or they've changed their calving grounds to potentially a less desirable area that has, perhaps that area has more bears, or the tundra doesn't have as much nutrition in it, or so there's these subsistence rights that go along with the that are being affected by the development of oil, but they also get money from the oil companies. So what you see is thousands of years of tradition and subsistence use of these lands, and only in the last 50 years money has come in to replace some of these values. And money brings lots of snow machines and four-wheelers and trucks, but the natives living out there aren't accustomed to money, and saving money or using it wisely often, they spend their money frivolously. And it's really sad to see some of these things replacing their traditional values with monetary items that, yeah. And some of the ideals that come along with it, having the biggest truck or the fastest snow machine, yeah. Is now something that's more important to the kids than getting out there and learning how to hunt or how to fish.
So being out there and studying the raptors, I'd imagine you get out to some pretty amazing places, and there must be some great stories of tracking birds or finding nesting sites or just discoveries out there in nature that you know, most people don't get to witness. What are some of the things that you've experienced out there?
Well, there's an unlimited number of amazing moments that you can have when you get away from an urban environment, and they're waiting for you around every bend in the river. There's lots of birds to discover, and with raptors, it's amazing to see how well adapted they are to hunting. Peregrine falcons are the fastest animal on the planet, and they have been clocked with a radar gun over 200 miles an hour.
Wow.
In a dive. They can't flap and fly a straight line.
Yeah.
That fast. There are faster birds, eider ducks, actually. But so it's amazing to see a peregrine falcon stoop out of the sky from, you know, half mile high, come down at speeds well over 100 or near 200 miles an hour, and strike a bird in midair, and then do a loop and catch the bird with their talons on the next pass.
Oh, wow. So the first one's just a knockout blow.
Yeah.
And then they still have to catch it.
And then they catch it. And what's even more amazing is to watch a breeding pair of falcons, hunt as a team on a bird. And one bird might force the bird up into the air higher and higher while the other bird comes out of nowhere to catch it.
Your dog Nally has come to join us.
Hi, Nally. Would you like to say a little something for the camera? Good girl.
All right, John. Well, we'll wrap it up here. Thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for the interview.
And stay warm up there.
We will.